fighting for America.
We did exactly what needed to be done in order to catch those who were guilty on 9/11 and to prevent a further attack. And we were successful on both parts.
This report says it was not successful.
The report's full of crap.
Fighting for Idaho.
The president has the legal authority now. It's exactly the same legal authority that he had 6 years ago, and he didn't do anything about it. And since then, he has deported more than 2 million immigrants.
Fighting for you.
No, Kevin, yes. I logged 35,000 miles on my Chevy pickup in the last year.
I hope it wasn't a lease.
And it wasn't. And our roads aren't bad.
Boise's Mr. Right, Kevin Miller in the Morning, winner of the 2014 Marconi Radio Award on 580 KIDO, Idaho's first radio station.
580 KIDO, K. Miller with you. Joining us now, our great friend Stephen Hunter, Sniper's Honor, a Bob Lee Swagger novel. Mr. Hunter, good morning.
Hi, how are you, Kevin?
Good to have you with us here at 580 KIDO. Let's talk a little bit about your new bestseller, why it's different from some of your previous 19 works.
It's different from 18 of them. It's not different from the 19th, which was the first one. Actually, I think the number is not 19. Well, it's novels. I think I have 23 total published works, but I'm not sure. I don't know this stuff. That's what I have a secretary for, except that I don't have a secretary, which is why I'm always a mess. Anyway, the great pleasure in me, in this book for me was returning to World War II. World War II was Lord of the Rings in real time, you know, in meat space. It was an incredible tapestry of violence and heroism and evil and betrayal and sacrifice and commitment and love and honor and death. It was every human emotion magnified 10 times. And maybe 20 times, maybe 50 times. And it was on a scale we no longer can comprehend. I mean, we get all upset when we lose 2,000 men. And, you know, we lost, and particularly the Russians lost, 2,000 men an hour in World War II. And it was that vast enterprise. And I, in this book, was attracted to go back to an obscure bunch of soldiers who were very effective, who fought really hard for their country, who were ill-used by their country, who were sacrificed for their country, and who never got the attention and the publicity and the love that they deserve. And I thought one of the ideas here was to give this figure a good showcase in Western popular culture, and that figure is the Soviet female sniper. The Soviets had, because they were so hard-pressed for bodies at a certain point in the war, they'd taken such enormous losses because Stalin was such an idiot that they asked women to become frontline snipers, and there are about 10,000 of them. They killed thousands and thousands of German soldiers. They took terrible casualties, and some of them racked up enormous scores. And it just turned out that it was, you know, this is not quite the same issue as women in combat, because they weren't integrated into male issues, which is a whole nother dynamic. But it turned out that as shooters, as stalkers, as the point of the point of the point of the spear in engagements from the Black Sea to the North Pole, the women were every bit as good and every bit as brave and every bit as accurate as the men. And it was, in a general sense, a great pleasure for me to pay attention and to create a sort of composite mythical Russian female sniper from 1944.
And yet these women existed, and, you know, pardon me for, you know, going into my Neanderthal past. I never heard about any female Russian snipers.
It's so strange that it never got the attention that I believe it deserved. And I hear this all the time, that people are astounded. It just goes to show that history is what historians decided is. That is, it's not reality. And I suppose because the scale was so much smaller than some of the engagements on the Eastern Front, that they never attracted the attention. In fact, the Soviets integrated women. They didn't integrate, but they had several different dimensions of female combat units. There was a night fighter unit that was scored significant victories against the Germans in aerial combat, and they were called the Night Witches. And the Germans, I don't know, again, they had this certain gifts. I don't know if it's gender specific, but they seemed to have very good night vision. They had, it's the same thing that makes a sniper, I think, makes a fighter pilot. Superb vision to begin with, superb hand-eye coordination, but also a patient heart and a willingness to let things develop. And also a particular capacity to pay great attention to detail and a capacity to understand sort of the mechanics and the conceptual things beneath the actual battle skills. And so in those two kinds of engagements, women were enormously successful. And if you haven't heard of it, it's because certain people charged with recording the past didn't do a good job.
Stephen Hunter with us, Kevin Miller in the Morning, talking about his new book, Sniper's Honor, on 580 KIDO. What about the, and you write about guns and bullets and everything else, but what about the insides of men and women? And I'm going to apologize for my sexism here, but again, the psychological makeup of a sniper back then, I'm thinking, okay, I get Rosie the Riveter. Sally the Sniper, I don't get.
The only thing I can say is we don't comprehend how total a war that was in the East. And we're able to comprehend Rosie the Riveter because we see her in terms that we understand. And because our nation was not invaded, our cities were not leveled, our vulnerable populations were not rounded up and executed, and a policy of atrocity was not in place against us. All that happened on the Russian front as per German standard operating procedure. And because, again, this monster Stalin was an idiot, he was completely unprepared. He fell back and fell back and fell back and lost hundreds of thousands of men. And by the middle of 1942, was in desperate straits and had lost millions of men. And he understood that the war was a total battle of two civilizations. And every last stop had to be pulled out. And we, you know, in the West, we protect women from the responsibility of sanctioned killing, you know, so we don't have women snipers. And that's a luxury of a society that's much more stable and under much less pressure. When, your very survival as a nation and as a culture and as a belief system is in dire jeopardy, all those polite rules go out the door, and you become willing to use any resource at your command. And it occurred to someone in the Soviet military that women had the skills. I mean, women were integrated into the army as radio operators, as medics. It was probably one of the most female armies in the world, but they also, it was felt, would work out well as snipers for a number of reasons. You know, the same thing, that shooting is kind of gender neutral. It has to do with how willing you are to do your homework and master the fundamentals. The second thing is sniping demands extremely clever stalking skills and great patience. Women, I'm generalizing here, but they tend, I think most people would agree, to be more patient than men. Another thing, let me just say this. In my life, five things have tried to kill me. They were all animals. and they were all mothers, and this all took place in Africa. And if you, you know, the rage of the mother protecting her cubs is one of the most malleable forces in nature. If you become, if you find yourself stupidly, as I did several times, between a mother and her cubs, she ceases to be a mother and becomes a total committed warrior. And I think that same mechanism, which I believe is rooted in biology, came into play in World War II. A, in a specific and exact reality that their children were in danger, but in the larger and more general reality that the nation's children were in danger. And as mothers or mothers-to-be or as potential mothers, they felt that incredibly powerful surge of the need to protect the den. And that's probably what drove them to some extraordinary accomplishments. And there's several had over 300 kills. They were very, very lethal and efficient at their job.
Based on upon your research for this project, though, what psychologically must people have to be effective snipers?
Well, again, you have to take it. I mean, I think like any highly skilled behavior, you have to begin with the fundamentals. You have to master. I mean, some people have talent and some people don't. Probably the more talented shooters became the better snipers, but regardless, one had to pay one's dues. And somehow I think in mastering the techniques of shooting, somehow you can make it more technical than psychological. You know, you're not killing a man. You can convince yourself you're reading the wind, concentrating on your hold, trying to figure out, get the best target resolution, waiting for the target to be still, trying to put yourself into the most solid position, having already laid out a route of escape, and, of course, in all of that, you have to worry about your breath control and the coordination between the nuance of the trigger pull and the nuance of the hold as you stay on the target. And so you can put all of that between yourself and the actual psychological fact that you are committing what in civilian capacity would be considered an act of murder. But you're able to suspend your sort of quotidian, I mean, killing is what war is about. And one of the things that the military is very good at is getting young men, and in this case, young women, to make that breakthrough and to understand that in the killing was not to be fetishized, not to be enjoyed, but was nevertheless extremely an extreme requirement, in that it was a sacrifice that our soldiers made for the folks back home, and, you know, every soldier makes for the folks back home, that he becomes the executioner, and he takes on the psychological weight of that. He takes on any guilt feelings. He understands that in some way, after having killed, and if he's had to kill a lot, he will be forever different, and he may find himself exiled. He may find himself shunned. He may exile himself. But that's just one of the sacrifices he makes to do a job that's very important. It's been my pleasure to try and document the effort, to not take it for granted, but to try and document the kind of precision and the kind of psychological intensity that it takes not only to commit the act, but then to recover from it. And one of the great pleasures of the Bob Lee Swagger books is I begin with him way back in 1993 as an exile, a drunken exile, and a trailer living in the woods. And what I have tracked over the subsequent 9 books is his return to civilization. his re-engagement in society, his ability to, I mean, he's learned how to relate to other people. He's fallen in love with a woman. He now has children, a family, a business. He's been rescued from the exile that he imposed on himself and was imposed on him after Vietnam as a sniper to become a really extraordinarily giving and contributing member of society. And it's been, you know, it's been, that's been the great flip.
Glenn Beck, weekdays at 9. Now back to Kevin Miller on 580 KIDO, Idaho's first radio station.
Kevin Miller in the morning as we continue on. Phone number is 580-5436, 580-KIDO. With us once again, bestselling author Stephen Hunter, Sniper's Honor. And Stephen, let's talk a little bit about the idea of fiction writing. We all love fiction, whether it's you or others. How do you actually come up with an alternate personality so compelling that we're so drawn to it that they develop a life of their own and then keep your sanity yourself?
It's one of the miracles of the business, and I can't really break it into segments and say, I do this, I do this, then I do this other thing, and finally I do this last thing. The only way I can describe it is that it's a process, and this is so trite. I'm disappointed in myself that I haven't come up with anything better, but it's a becoming. What you end up doing is breaking down the barriers between yourself and the material in the book and the characters in the book, and I kind of encouraging them to take over. And when I'm deep into a book, it's not uncommon for me just to sort of trance out in all kinds of, you know, ridiculous places. It gets me tickets. I hope I don't kill anybody in a car accident. It hasn't happened yet, but maybe that's how I'll check out. I don't know. But these ideas, you know, it's just that I've sort of given my total subconscious over to the prospect of the book, and the subconscious, it's working continually, and when it has a discovery, it sort of takes over my conscious, and it puts me there. And I, you know, I'll be sitting in the strangest places. I was a movie critic for a number of years, and I remember sitting in a movie in a theater on a professional engagement, and suddenly a book, the solution to a book problem occurred to me, and I had, you know, 30 minutes of reverie as I worked out how it would happen, this, that, and the other thing. And then suddenly I realized I totally lost contact with the movie. And I had no idea what the movie was about. I hope I had the courage to see it again before I wrote a piece about it. I was under so much pressure, I admit I probably didn't. But it's just another cliche. I so wish I could do better for you. It's like a Vulcan mind meld, you know. It's just you just sort of enter a world. Your subconscious lets you enter a world, and sometimes I feel like I'm merely a recording secretary. I'm not writing at all. I'm just getting stuff down as it comes to me from I don't know where. And I guess the I don't know where really is my subconscious, but it's a very strange process. But on the other hand, if you do it long enough, you get so that you can get into that. You need a certain intensity of concentration, and I think where novelists burn out and where they suddenly lose their audience and their gift is that they can no longer summon the level of concentration it takes. I think it's true of athletes too, but that level of concentration you need, you can't get up there anymore. And the lesser concentration just doesn't get it done. And one of the things I believe I've gotten good at, or at least professional at over the years, is I can get into that concentration, I can get into it pretty easily, and I can't stay there long. I'm not a guy for 8 or 12 hour days, but I can get there. I can do, you know, the work of the day, and then I get out real quick. And it's just psychologically, it's a very curious sort of sense of travel or of being occupied or of a different presence in your mind. And I suppose it's a gift. I don't know if it's a gift or a curse, but that's just the way it seems to work. And you sort of develop strategies to get the best out of it and, train it to be reliable. I know I'm sounding sort of incoherent here, and the radios all over Boise here are, going off. I'm sorry for that.
Yeah, gee, thanks for that, Stephen, by the way. I appreciate it.
Okay. I can't get any more specific than that because it doesn't feel any more specific than that to me.
Finally, you get to ask this all the time, but, everybody wants to be a rock star or a writer. Your advice to aspiring Stephen Hunters of the world?
Work. There's three things that make a career. Talent, maybe you've got it, maybe you don't. Luck, maybe you'll get it, maybe you won't. There are things that can be done to improve the odds. Anyone can find them out by doing some research on the internet. But you've got to do the work, because everybody you're competing with is beating that animal down, and they are doing the work. I can't tell you how many times at book signings I hear from people who say, I've got a great idea for a book, but Mary won't let me alone on the weekends because I've always got all these chores to do, and I just can't seem to get started. And I smile, and I'm always sympathetic and polite, as raised in the Midwest, and I wish them luck, and, but I know that they're losers, and that they'll never get that book done, because at a certain point, you have to be sort of selfish, and you have to say to Mary, honey, I'm not going to run the junk to the dump today. Goodbye, and go in the bedroom and close the door and do the work. You have to do the work every day. And when you finally get a break, my big break was that when an editor said to me, do you have anything to show me? You sound like a writer. Do you have anything to show me? Damn it, yes, I did have something to show her. And my whole career is based on the fact that I had something to show her. I'd already written the book. I had the manuscript. I'd finished it. And, I didn't describe, I didn't have dreams, I didn't have hopes, I didn't have a plot, I didn't have a synopsis. I had a book, and she was able to look at that book and see that I was of professional caliber. And the only way you're ever going to find out if you're of professional caliber is if you write the damn book. Stop talking about it. Stop dreaming about it. Write the damn book.
Until we meet again, sir.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Kevin. You were great.
Take care, Stephen. It's our great friend. Sorry about that. Great guy, though. You're listening to Kevin Miller on 580 KIDO.
Speak up. Talk to your neighbors, because a lot of people don't get the information from the mainstream media. Pay attention. Keep listening to the Kevin Miller Show.
Earning your trust every morning.
Thank God it's
Kevin Miller, winner of the 2014 Marconi Radio Award on 580 KIDO, Idaho's first radio station.
Kevin Miller in the morning, 580 KIDO. Joining us now, Dr. Paul Ruggieri, the author of Cost Cutting, A Surgeon Reveals the Truth Behind a Multi-Billion Dollar Industry. Dr. Ruggieri, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you're a practicing surgeon.
Correct.
And you want to reveal the truth behind the curtain. What gives?
Public needs to know the truth about a lot of things in life, particularly in medicine, particularly in surgery. They need to be educated about what's going on so they can themselves make good decisions on choosing a surgeon and where to have their operation.
Well, we're all so squeamish about going into surgery. What really goes on?
Well, most of the time, surgery goes very well. Surgery is very effective, very successful in this country in helping a lot of people's ailments. And sometimes it doesn't go well. But there are influences, business influences, today than no other time in our history that affect who you may see as a surgeon, where you may have your operation, in the end, that may ultimately affect your health care.
Well, Dr. Ruggieri, how long have you been practicing?
22 years.
And what are the changes that you've seen in the last 22 years?
Well, there's been a lot of changes. I mean, just from a surgical standpoint, beginning of laparoscopic minimally invasive surgery has changed the dynamics greatly. Patients have benefited from smaller incisions, smaller surgeries. On the business side, there's been some dramatic changes, as you know, particularly from the Affordable Care Act, that's created an environment, particularly, that makes it very difficult for independent practitioners like myself to be competitive and compete with hospital systems.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that when we're talking about the impacts of Obamacare on our health system.
From my perspective, the Affordable Care Act has really stimulated an environment where hospitals, seeing they're going to be getting less federal money for Medicare patients, are buying up practices, surgeons' practices, specialty practices. They're buying up smaller hospitals. They're trying to really corner the market on their consumers who consume their services. And as an independent practitioner, they are competing directly with me for patients, and they're able to control their patients and generate as much revenue as they can from every stop of that patient along the way to the operating room.
And what does that mean when for the consumer?
Well, it can mean you may not have a great choice in choosing who your surgeon is. If your regular doctor is an employee of a hospital system, guess where that regular doctor is going to send you to? He's going to send you to a surgeon who's employed by that hospital system. And in communities, you may have some other surgeons who have more experience in particular operations that you may never get to see.
And that is a tough part. A lot of people say, you know, I want to keep my doctor, I want to keep my health plan. Mm-hmm. That doesn't seem to be the case.
Generally, it's not going that way. No, it's not. And patient choice, I believe, has really been compromised by a lot of this. Unless you really speak up, and if you speak up and have a voice for your own health care, you still will have a choice. But many patients are afraid to speak up. They're afraid to say things that may anger their doctors or that may go against what their doctor recommends.
And why do they? Why are they afraid?
Well, I think it's just been that way for a long, long time. I mean, the doctor has the white coat. They're the ones with the expertise. And most people trust their doctors as well as they should. But today there's influences outside of just practicing good medicine that affect where patients are going and where they're operated on.
Has it gotten worse? Have we gone from the non-caring HMO bureaucrats to the non-caring government bureaucrats?
Oh, in some ways we have. No question about that. The bureaucracy is much bigger. Unfortunately, you know, physicians really they've lost control of their independence for a lot of reasons. And they're kind of just cogs in the big wheel.
You think that's going to impact people going into medicine?
You would think it would. You know, it's interesting. It did initially, but medical school applications are up, believe it or not. And I think they're up because as a doctor or a specialist or a surgeon, you'll have a good job. You'll always have a decent living. Healthcare, that's where the growth is. So I think people are still going into medicine, but certain specialties, there's a shortage, like in my specialty, for instance, in surgery. Many of the surgical subspecialties are not filling, and that could be a problem with patient access.
Although you do have to wonder about the student loan debt you have to take out.
Well, unfortunately, it is a problem. I mean, the average medical student graduating today has a total cumulative debt. It's in six figures easily.
I have a friend of mine. His son is going into residency over $350,000 already.
Yeah, that's tough. You know, that would have been me unless I spent 3 years in the military. They paid for 3 years of my education, so that would have been me otherwise.
So that won't dissuade people. Of course, the growth going into healthcare. What about the idea of, you know, getting sued all the time? That's got to impact medicine as well.
Well, you know, it does. Unfortunately, it's the cost of doing business. I mean, I've been at it for long enough that it's something that is part of our business. I mean, most states mandate you have malpractice insurance. Certain states don't. There are very few. But that money paying malpractice insurance comes right off the top. I mean, it can range from anywhere from $40,000 to a couple $100,000, depending on the specialty you're in. It's there. There's nothing you can do about it.
The cost of cutting, a surgeon reveals the truth behind a multi-billion dollar industry. Dr. Paul Ruggieri with us, Kevin Miller in the morning at 580KIDO. What about the whole business side? You know, people will go in and seem to have major surgery. You know, they put them on the table, and then they're out the door within 24 hours because the insurance will only pay so much. What impact does that have on healing?
Well, you know, a lot of surgery has evolved to that. I do a lot of outpatient minimally invasive surgery, and it's safe. It's effective. It's taken us decades to get to this point. So a lot of that surgery is safe clinically. Now, on the insurance side, of course, yeah, insurance companies don't want you to stay in the hospital because it costs a lot of money for someone to stay in the hospital. So they are pushing you to get out of the hospital. Hospitals are pushing you to get out of their hospital because it costs them money if you stay. And particularly with today's environment, there's only so many healthcare dollars to go around in the private sector and on the federal level.
Isn't that what you pay for insurance, though?
You would think. I know. Right. Well, it's like any insurance. You pay for insurance, and when you actually need it, how much do you get? Most surgery today is done on an outpatient basis, particularly what I do, and it is safe. It's safe and it's effective if it's done correctly. Now, there are other operations that people need to stay in the hospital for. But the push today is to get people out of the hospital because it costs money. Beds cost money when they're filled in the hospital.
What should people listening right now at 580KIDO know about before they consider going under the knife?
Well, I think they need to know. They need to find out, first of all, who their surgeon is and how experienced their surgeon is. They need to find out from if they were referred to a particular surgeon based on expertise, based on experience, based on a relationship between the primary care doctor and that surgeon, not just based on a financial employment agreement that both work for the same hospital system. And it's automatic you go to the surgeon who works for the hospital system, regardless of knowing their outcomes. Patients need to be aware of that. They can ask questions. They can ask their primary care doctor, why are you sending me to this particular surgeon? Is it because you know of good outcomes? You have a good relationship? Are there other surgeons that you can refer me to that have more experience? Patients really have to ask questions right up front. And then when they get to a surgeon, they have to ask even more questions about their experience. So how many of these operations do you do a week, a month, a year? Practice makes perfect, even in surgery.
On the other hand, people might be intimidated because they don't want to anger this guy that's going to
gut them. Well, that's true. But, you know, they got to get over that. Because if your doc or surgeon gets angry, I would go find another surgeon. I would get another opinion.
Can you do that?
Opinions are very good.
Can you do that in today's world of, hey, you're in this system, get in there and get it done?
Well, that's a good question. You know, you can probably see another surgeon in the same system. Won't cost you anymore. But if you go outside that network, that system, it's going to cost you more. That's the trade-off. They tell you you have a choice. You can see whoever you want to see. In reality, that's not the case.
How has the Affordable Care Act made the situation worse?
Well, I think it's made it worse in the sense that many of these network exchanges that people are getting, these health insurance on the networks, they're very narrow networks. There's only a certain percentage of physicians in this country, specialists, who want to participate in those networks. And patients, you know, their choice is limited. Their choice really is limited. So I think in that regard, those networks aren't very favorable to physicians as far as paying them. So that's why they're not appealing to a lot of docs in this country. They don't want to be part of it.
Right.
That's becoming more and more evident. Recent studies have shown this. So patients have only a choice of the physicians who want to participate in these health exchanges. And maybe these physicians don't have the best experience, particularly the surgeons at some of these operations. But they're never going to know that.
Hmm. Anything else you'd like to share with us?
Yeah, I think patients need to be advocates for their own health care. They really have to speak up from the beginning of the process. From the time they step into a doctor's office to the time they get to see a surgeon, they need to just ask questions and find out, you know, why am I seeing this person? What's going on? Bring somebody with you. Take some notes. Do some research before you even step into a surgeon's office. You can go on the Internet. The Internet's good and bad, but there are some things that can prompt some questions. You can't just sit back and let the system push you along the way. You need to question things along the way. And second opinions, get a second opinion. If there's any doubt in your mind, if you're not happy with what you hear, get a second opinion.
You're not going to hurt anybody's feelings.
No. And who cares if you do? Who cares?
I don't know. You guys have long memories.
It shouldn't hurt anybody's feelings. Most people I work with would be happy to send their patients for a second opinion. They'll get on the phone. And eventually what happens is those patients come back to see you for their surgery because they trust you because you sent them for another opinion. The opinion was correct, and they'll come back to you.
Dr. Ruggieri, the cost of cutting a surgeon reveals the truth behind a multi-billion-dollar industry. Thank you, sir.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
Kevin Miller in the Morning, 580 KIDO. We hope you enjoyed our great friend, Dr. Paul Ruggieri. Coming up, Jeff Bacon and the Wyakin Warriors, why it's important to you to support our troops right here at 580 KIDO. Hey, thank you for starting your day with us. Kevin Miller in the Morning, 580 KIDO. Good to have you with us, and we're so thankful to be with you. This is a marvelous forum, a privilege in the age of all these other digital elements that we have to be on Idaho's first form of electronic media, electronic communication. In fact, I always like to tell folks, if it hadn't been for AM radio, there would be no FM radio, there would be no television, there would be no texting, there would be none of what we have today. And I understand that, but 85 years ago, this great station was launched, and like I say time and time again, I am so honored that you listen. Fox News is next. Stay here, stay informed. You're listening to Kevin Miller, 580 KIDO.